Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG online, kpcg.fm, and we have our live link at thetrumpet.com as well. Coming up on this Thursday edition, oil prices are coming down again, it looks like, so that might mean some savings at the pump. Reading literature makes us smarter and nicer. That's a story that Grant has for us. And IBM has figured out how to store data on a single atom. Technology just keeps rolling along. Also, Trump, Russia, and Churchill's wisdom. That and more this edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio. We're at 101.3 KPCG over the air here in Edmond, Oklahoma City area, and of course online. A couple of places to check us out, kpcg.fm or livelink at thetrumpet.com. Or you can use the TuneIn app or a few other devices or apps like that that'll get you there too. So thanks for joining us on those various platforms today. I'm Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, and Abraham Blondeau here. The three-headed monster returns yet again. Oil prices might be coming down here in the U.S. a little bit. That's from CNBC Business. It says, market alert. U.S. oil price plunges toward $50 as a perfect storm brews. Oil is on track to break through the key psychological level of $50 a barrel after a ninth straight rise in U.S. crude stockpiles came at exactly the wrong moment, they said, analysts said. So I guess that's the level psychologically for investors or something. If it goes under 50, it changes the way they feel about it. I feel quite comfortable, but apparently it bothers somebody. Lower the better, I think. The amount of crude oil in the U.S. storage rose to another record high on Wednesday, jumping 8.2 million barrels from the previous week. That is four times what analysts expected. So it's always an interesting game because the oil's there one way or the other. But we just kind of play this game where it's like, well, how much do we have? Or how much is available? Even though, I mean, technically, there's a lot available. There always is. It's just a matter of how much they're making. But in any event, weekly figures also showed U.S. oil production continuing to tick up toward 9.1 million barrels per day. And so they're thinking that some of the other countries like Russia and the 10 other exporters that are in the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries may need to continue to cut their output because they want the level to stay high so they can make money. But so I know it has effects in the economy. It ripples down to different things. But for us at the pumps, it might be a better deal. Prices might be coming down. They should be. Isn't that funny how like the oil will drop, the gas prices stay for a little bit. But then as soon as the oil ticks up, it's like immediately on the gas prices. It seems like it's not a fair trade there.
Yeah, there's just in Oklahoma here in the local area, there's a, once you pass I-35 going east, there's like one gas station for miles around, and they're sometimes 20 cents more, or maybe not 20 cents, but like 20 percent more than other their local competitor. Yeah. Like for gas rates, they're just so much more than everyone else around them. And they just built this huge super gas station off of I-35
there. I saw it.
Which would be nice because it'll give them a lot of competition. They'll have to lower their prices because they can just gouge you, and especially if it's the only one around. There's nothing you can really do about it.
Yeah, that happens even some of the little ones that are out here a little ways. And you know, either you're going to go into town and get gas or you're going to stop and get gas out here. And if you do it out here, you're going to pay more. And then if you go inside and get a snack or something, they also are going to charge you more there because you got to make that decision. You know, you pay a dollar more for the item or you drive to town to get it. So they know. They kind of got you in the...
Pretty smart.
They got you there. So in Oklahoma, the average gas price right now is $2.09 per gallon on average. California, they're always more expensive, just a little over $3. Hawaii is the most expensive state at $3 and about 0.6 cents. 0.06 cents. So, Hawaii is more expensive, I guess, because costs more to get it out there, transport or something.
Remember when recently it was pretty normal to hear prices around like $450 or even up close to $500 or even above $500, and now like going below $200 is pretty common a lot of the time. We're pretty close right now.
Yeah, I definitely remember that, you know, how it jumped up, and everyone was trying to get rid of their SUVs and their trucks and everything, and then the prices came down. So it's been pretty low for a couple of years now, it seems like.
Yeah, it's such a volatile market, especially if you're in that industry, because I mean, if another competing company happened to strike it big, then you have billions more barrels of oil going into the market, which would then bring down the costs a whole lot. So if that happens, all of a sudden you're making a lot less money, even though you didn't find the oil yourself.
Yeah, and the difficulty is a lot of oil companies, I think, you know, they begin to build infrastructure on borrowed money, the assumption being that the well will pay you back. And then if the prices drop, then there you are sitting with this debt. And that happened to some companies here in Oklahoma that really were major parts of the economy. And then, of course, when the bottom falls out of the prices, it can do a lot of damage. So there's got to be, I suppose, some sort of happy medium where you're not paying a ton at the pump, but at the same time, the companies can do okay. I don't know where that is, but I'm still waiting on my solar-powered car. That hasn't shown up yet. Where is it?
I'm waiting for my windmill-powered car, the air power.
Wow.
I actually saw that. I saw one of those. not seriously, but I saw a pickup in town, and they were bringing home a little windmill. It was in the back, like a garden decoration. And I remember we pulled up behind it. I told my wife, I'm like, look at that. Things are running on a windmill power.
Yeah, or has a propeller. So it's like you forgot the wings, though.
Yeah, well, that would be perfect because you'd be creating your own wind while you're driving. It's powering your car.
Yeah.
What was that thing you saw in your neighbor, like a motorized bar stool or something?
Yes.
Like on a platform.
Yeah, it's like on a... like on a lawnmower
That's
base.
Hilarious.
Yeah, and then one of the fellows we work with here, he knows the guy that built it. So like I thought it was kind of like Bigfoot to me. I'm like, did I really see that or was I? And he confirmed that it was a real thing. So all kinds of vehicles out there. We've had a bad flu season, right? I think everybody would agree with that. It's been, especially in Oklahoma, I got hit with it. Grant, you did. Yep. How about you, Abraham?
I haven't yet, but at the school Grant and I teach at, there's been more and more kids every single day not coming to school because they're sick with something, and they're so sick they can't even lift their head off their pillow. Ugh. It's like a really bad head cold or something.
Yeah. That's just recently now?
Yeah, just today.
Oh, brother. Mm-hmm. It just keeps coming around, it seems like, in these different, you know, different ways. Well, so it's been a bad flu season, and now there's something else they're keeping their eye on. Probably won't be as big of a deal, but it is something to note. This is from CNN. U.S. officials keep watchful eye on yellow fever outbreak in Brazil. Kind of like the Zika virus, they're afraid that it's going to make its way other places, get out of Brazil and make it up to the U.S. So Brazil's just got some problems. An outbreak of yellow fever in rural Brazil is raising concerns that the disease could spread across the borders to the U.S., just like Zika did, they say. While the likelihood of yellow fever outbreaks in the U.S. is pretty low, travel-related cases of yellow fever could occur. So if we have people vacationing down there in Brazil and coming back, there's a chance. You got to be careful, I guess. And especially local transmission in warmer regions such as the Gulf Coast states. In an area of frequent international travel, any marked increase in domestic cases is in Brazil raises the possibility of travel-related cases. They wrote in this medical journal, and experts fear spread of the disease may resemble that of the Zika virus, which emerged in Brazil in 2015. Later spread to more than 60 countries, including the U.S., causing local outbreaks in Florida. And so they're keeping an eye on it anyway. As of March the 2nd, the virus has killed an estimated 220 people, which isn't a lot, but of course it could spread. According to an update from the Pan American Health Organization, the health agency also counted 326 confirmed cases and 916 suspected cases of the disease. If you get it, the fatality rate is 33%. Probably old and young, I suppose, kind of like a lot of other things. And symptoms are similar to the flu. Could become severe to include fever, headache, muscle pain, nausea, vomiting, fatigue, and jaundice, hence its name, yellow fever. So isn't that like, those are like the symptoms of every disease. Maybe not the jaundice necessarily, but yeah, just about every other one of those could be a lot of things, a common flu or something more serious. So I guess you just never know.
Yeah, it just shows the need for like sanitation practice. I know that's not too great in Brazil or a lot of developing or underdeveloped countries. Sanitation, water, sewage, those types of things are not really handled too well there. And then you just see diseases breaking out from Brazil all the time.
They just had the carnival, right, down there. Maybe, I don't know if it's still going on, but I saw a story on it. They do that every year. And it's presented like it's a fun thing. And then they showed like the pictures of it. And I was thinking, I don't think I'd want to be there. It always looks scary to me. I'm not sure what's going on, but it seems a little frightening. And then the diseases come. So probably not related, but same area.
Yeah, it seems like whenever there's a big public event in Brazil, it's associated with a small epidemic.
Yeah.
Like the Olympics and then this. Just reading about even the tourism of Brazil, because that's a huge part of their economy. Even when you go to their beaches, it's just filled with garbage. And like, it's just people come and go all the time. And it's they're really suffering down there to try to fix that, because you just have thousands of people come, leave just their trash on the beach. And then you also have, like what Grant talked about, the sewage problem. So it's just they're finding hard to attract international visitors. I mean, and have 33% chance of dying from yellow fever. It doesn't make it any better.
Yeah, it's one of those diseases that I think we're familiar with the name of it, but I couldn't tell you anyone that's ever had it or died from it, you know. So it's interesting too, because the numbers are pretty low, you know, 200 and something died from it, but if you're one of those 200, that's pretty high, right? Yeah. It all depends on how you look at it, but hopefully it won't be an issue. But of course, mosquitoes and those types of things you have to watch out for. We've talked before about, you know, if you go to the zoo, and for me anyway, I look down into the alligator pit, whatever you call that, and it's fascinating. But I always think if I fell in there, it'd be, you know, bad for me. Good for the alligators, bad for me. There's lots of alligators that they found. This wildlife photographer, Lee Dalton, he captured this beautiful, they say, but horrifying sight. A group of nearly 200 alligators sunbathing together in a watering hole in Florida. And you see the picture. There's 200 of them just all sitting there. What would they be? Would it be better for you or worse if you got caught in that? Because they'd have to make a decision, like who's going to go after this guy. If it was just one, maybe it'd be obvious he's coming after you. But if there's 200, so I was trying to think, would it be better to stumble upon 200 or one? Which would be worse?
I think the more, the quicker it would probably be. So instead of just one, but
they might pull you in different directions, though. So yeah, that wouldn't be enjoyable.
Well, I was hoping they would like start fighting each other. You know, like they want to get over there, so they'd be distracted, and maybe I could.
All 200, though? You think all 200 would not?
Probably
go
not.
Toward the
it probably wouldn't end well. Maybe I could just float there, and hopefully no one would notice.
Like a log.
Yeah. What is that thing?
Yeah, it'd be. I remember in China, a similar story about tigers, and because these tigers caught a drone and ripped it apart.
Oh, wow.
And
caught a what? Sorry, what was it?
A drone.
Oh, a drone.
They were taping or trying to get some footage of the tigers.
Yeah.
And a tiger jumped in the air of nowhere and batted down. They just ripped the drone apart. And the author said, what's more terrifying than having one Siberian tiger chase you? And he said, 10. And there were like 10 tigers chasing this drone around.
Wow.
In China. So with 200 alligators, that would be just absolutely terrifying, even if you got a head start.
Yeah. Well, related to that drone story, there's this video on YouTube that's kind of popular. Somebody was flying a drone around, and they were taking video near this lady's house. And on the video, she opens a window and points a gun out, like a rifle. And I think she took a shot at the drone. So they put it up. I must have missed, because they have the video on YouTube. Maybe she didn't miss. I don't know. But so, yeah, people don't like drones. Tigers don't like them. People don't like them. I'm imagining alligators wouldn't like them. But it does open up a really fascinating way to capture wildlife footage. Because you could never walk in there. I mean, this guy got close enough to get a good photo, but imagine flying that drone around. You know, you could get some really amazing shots.
Yeah, well, I think that's the big way how they're doing it now. Because before, if you want to get aerial footage, you need a plane or helicopter, which are really noisy. If you get a small drone, it's not as loud, doesn't scare the animals, and you can get closer. So with Planet Earth 2, that big new documentary just came out on BBC. And some of the footage they have is absolutely amazing. And all of it is from drones, but some of it is, and it's pretty incredible what they can capture.
For sure. This this photographer that got all these alligators, he took the picture at, I think it's pronounced Myakka River State Park in Florida. And there are so many of the massive beasts gathered together at the sinkhole that they can be seen on Google Earth satellite photos. You could go down and look at that area, and you can see them all, which is amazing. 200. Anyway, the picture's online. You could find it. It's linked at different places. But yeah, it's funny how we're so terrified of them, but they're very obviously comfortable with each other. They just all hang out.
Yeah, thankfully they don't eat each other normally, I would think, so they can just relax around fellow killer beasts.
Somebody was asking in the comments section, they said, well, how could they eat? Because there's so many of them, is there enough food? But somebody else commented and said there's a lot of, that area's got a lot of wildlife, so enough to eat, obviously. They know where to hang out.
And they're probably a lot faster than you would think, even though they have those short, stubby arms. They can probably swim extremely fast and then move almost as fast on land.
Yeah, it's amazing. So a pretty neat picture there, and pretty terrifying too in some ways. A job that people probably don't love, it's, you know, a job sometimes you have as a younger person or sometimes older people, but a lot of times teenagers, fast food and being a burger flipper, as they call it. Well, there's a new technology that's replacing those people. It's a robotic burger flipper. So this is a new thing. They're using it. It's never been a particularly sought after job, they say, but now flipping burgers may not be a job for humans at all. Meet Flippy. That's what they call him, Flippy. It sounds like a dolphin, but it's a burger flipper. Flipper and Flippy. Meet Flippy, a new robotic kitchen assistant from Mizo Robotics that, as its name suggests, will automate the process of cooking those juicy patties. So maybe some people are going to lose some jobs over that. Maybe that's for the best. I don't know.
Yeah, there's been a big fear lately about robots replacing a lot of the jobs that a lot of young people or maybe lower income people could work. Because they didn't require a whole lot of skill. It's something you could pick up for a while until you find something else. But with all these robots coming in, because we're at a threshold in the technology where they're more viable, they could really impact the lower income population because all these jobs are disappeared. And now they either have to go to school to get higher skilled maybe or just go on welfare.
You know what they really should do? You know what would be a fascinating new TV show? Would be to look at where these robots are trying to take some of these jobs and then find people that are good at those jobs and have them have a contest. Like, see who's better. Is Flippy better or is the guy doing it? That would be an interesting show anyway, to, you know, man versus machine to see who could win at the contest.
I'd definitely go with the man in most cases. I mean, the robot, especially when it comes to cooking your food, it's not going to notice if, you know, there's a hair on it or something, or, you know, if it's way, way, way undercooked sometimes, it probably won't even realize that. Whereas if you're a human being, you could see those things and fix the situation.
Yeah, that's a good point because these robots are designed to do a certain number of functions and sort of make a few choices maybe, but not like a human, you know, a human. Right. Things come up during the day that you have to deal with that are outside of the box of a few set instructions, and you've got to make a decision on it. So anyway, it's interesting to see how these things are changing. The CEO of Mizo Robotics and co-founder David Zito, he told TechCrunch, "We are focusing on using artificial intelligence and automation to solve the high pain points in restaurants and food prep. And that would be the dull, dirty, and dangerous work around the grill, the fryer, and other prep work like chopping onions. The idea is to help restaurants improve food quality and safety without requiring a major kitchen redesign." So I imagine they'd be quite expensive to buy, and you'd have to pay somebody to maintain them. But I suppose if you looked at it, you know, over the course of 10 years, once you've paid for it, you've paid for it. You don't have to pay the salary. It's not coming in late. It's not going to have a bad day, unless it doesn't work, like it breaks down. Doesn't give you any attitude. You know, there are some benefits to it, I guess, if you were the owner of a company like that. And hopefully, I mean, hopefully other jobs open up where people could, you know, move to those that would be a little more, require a little more skill and hopefully pay a little better, too. So maybe that'll happen. Maybe you can get one for home, for like you're grilling in the backyard. You roll Flippy out there to take care of your grill for you.
I wonder if McDonald's, if they ever do this, has the robots look like Ronald McDonald, like this huge clown in the back cutting onions and flipping burgers. And
that would be horrifying. That's the scariest image I've ever thought of, actually.
It would become an attraction, probably. People just going to watch the gigantic clown in the back.
Yeah. I wonder if they've designed them to cry when they cut the onions. artificial tears come down. That'd be great. So that's interesting. The technology is changing, and of course we see it popping up here and there, kind of like the self checkouts. That's sort of happening. I always feel like I should be paid for that. Like,
right?
Am I on the clock? Why am I checking myself out?
You should get a discount every time you use a self checkout.
There should be a discount.
You're doing a job to even get your groceries out of there.
Yeah.
They should pay you for whatever groceries you scan. You should get your money for them.
There should be something. I don't know about that, but there should be something. Yeah. Kind of related to that, this is kind of interesting little write-up. For those people that like In-N-Out Burger, you guys ever eaten at In-N-Out Burger?
Just a couple days ago, actually.
Did you?
Yeah.
Oh, great. Where was that?
Well, Las Vegas, actually. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
When I was at the Trump International Hotel over the weekend, and they had one on the Strip, so it's pretty cool.
Wow, awesome. Yeah. You ever eaten at a...
Yes, a couple times.
Yeah.
I think in Texas.
Yep,
both
Dallas.
Times. Yeah.
Yeah, there's not a lot of them around, or they're not all over the U.S. They're only in certain locations. And I've eaten at one time. They're kind of famous, I guess. People say, oh, you got to try it. So it's good. Here's five things that they say you didn't know about In-N-Out. It's such an aggressive headline. How do they know?
How could they possibly know?
How about five things you may not know? You may find interesting about In-N-Out Burger. They say there are no franchises. A lot of times restaurants, they, you know, it's kind of locally, you have a different franchise, and people that own that restaurant, they do things their own way, but not in this case. They want it all to be sort of the same, so no franchises. It's all controlled by the same main company. Lindsay Torres is the youngest American female billionaire. She's the owner of In-N-Out Burger. That's a lot of burgers. $1 billion worth.
You know, they make a ton of money too, because every time you go into one of those places, it's completely full. There's a gigantic line, but they have like 15 or 20 workers who are just mowing through these orders rapid fire. I mean, that's a really good employer too. They employ a lot of people because they're obviously really necessary people for the assembly line.
Yeah, they say due to a string of untimely family deaths, seems a little strange, the 31-year-old Torres is now the sole owner of the chain, and it's worth about $1 billion. It's owned by a trust, or controlled by a trust. She was granted half of the company when she turned 30. She got the other half when she turns 35.
Wow.
So it must be something with those 5 years in there where they feel like, you know, okay, now we can trust you.
Now she's a grown woman.
Yeah. Another thing you may not know, all locations need to be near distribution centers. That's why they're in mostly California and in Dallas. That's where the distribution centers are. Because every restaurant has to be within one day's drive because they want the ingredients to be fresh. So there you go. That's pretty cool.
It does taste really good, too. I mean, it does stand out.
Yeah. There's an exact replica of the original. The original doesn't exist, but they built a replica, and people like to look at it. It's a tourist attraction. It has the antique kitchen equipment in it as well. And finally, there are some that don't have a drive-through. I guess they were kind of considered the restaurant that maybe started the drive-through. That might be debatable. But a lot of the locations don't have a drive-through. So anyway, some things you may not know about In-N-Out Burger. We don't have any here in Oklahoma that I'm aware of. I think Texas is the closest. Mm-hmm. So if you get a chance, they are pretty good.
It's only a few hours south, so
yeah,
worth it probably.
Yeah. So of course this one happened. This is like, this can't be real, but it is. This is from Miami. Miami lawyer's pants erupt in flames during arson trial. This is real. A Miami defense lawyer's pants burst into flames Wednesday afternoon as he began his closing arguments in front of a jury in an arson case.
Extreme irony.
Yeah, well, maybe.
Unless he planned it.
That's the question. Did he plan it? It's because he stunned everyone. Did he plan it? He says he didn't. Stephen Gutierrez, who was arguing that his client's car spontaneously combusted and was not intentionally set on fire, had been fiddling in his pocket as he was about to address jurors when smoke began billowing out of his right pocket. He rushed out of the Miami courtroom, leaving spectators stunned. After jurors were ushered out, Gutierrez returned unharmed with a singed pocket and insisted it wasn't a staged defense demonstration gone wrong. Instead, Gutierrez blamed a faulty battery in an e-cigarette. It was surreal, one observer told the Miami Herald. Okay, so he's defending a guy, claiming that his car just burst into flames and that the guy didn't set it on fire. As he's making his closing argument, his pants burst into flames.
Right after fiddling in his pocket, too, right. Which makes you think, like, maybe both of those guys set their things on fire.
Too strange. It must have been set up.
Yeah, it's... I was imagining, like, suddenly he was in the middle of this oratory and his pants just burst into flames right in front of everyone. But but yeah, that's e-cigarettes are dangerous, though, because it happens a lot. Or with the Nokia Notebook 7s or
yeah,
whatever those were, that with the lithium batteries. It's tons of videos of people just doing normal tasks, and then suddenly their pants burst into flames.
Right. Seems like a setup, but that's just... That one will live in infamy. Keith David program, Trump Daily Radio Show coming up. Also, a new sun also rises today on KPCG. You're listening to Trump Radio Live at 101.3. And you can follow us on Twitter at KPCGFM. Also, email us any comments you have, comments@kpcg.fm. Dwight Falk, Grant Turge, and Abraham Blondeau here today. And Grant, you got a really interesting article here. This is from ideas.time.com. They say reading literature makes us smarter and nicer. So reading is a good idea, I suppose.
Yeah, I think this was pretty interesting. This was from a couple years ago, but I believe it's a timeless piece. It remains true to this day. And basically, it's talking about how the more people read, and what it's talking about is deep reading. And later on in the article, it talks about how it's spiritual reading versus carnal reading. So really getting into it, usually on the pages of a book instead of on the web, where you can be distracted by links and all these other photos and things like that. But deep reading, where you really immerse yourself in the book, especially if it's literature or some type of fiction, it can help you empathize with the character's situation and have better understanding for other people in that way.
Yeah, I think I think there's a certain zone you can kind of get into when you're reading. You know, sometimes it takes a little while to really become engrossed in it, and then you know, you kind of forget that you're reading, and all of a sudden an hour's gone by. That happens, and I think that's what they're talking about. But, you know, I was thinking about, like, in high school there were certain books that we had to read for classes. One of them was To Kill a Mockingbird. And I remember, you know, that one very much making me empathize with the characters quite a bit and the story and what they went through. And so I could see that being the case.
Yeah, and there definitely should be a balance. This, in no way are we condoning just reading fictional books, but In a lot of fictional books, they're setting up a story. There are a lot of emotional situations. There are moral dilemmas that the characters face. Whereas if you're talking about history, a lot of the time it recounts the events, but there's not always some sort of, like, put yourself in his shoes moment where you have to try to see what you would do in that same situation. Although some history has that as well, but there definitely just has to be a balance. You know, being able to empathize with one situation does not mean it is the best logical choice. I mean, especially when you think about, like, policy making in a nation, because one refugee is suffering from a bill does not mean that the bill overall was a bad idea. That's kind of like reading a fictional book and then thinking that that should apply to all people.
Right. I mean, the example of Abraham Lincoln, right? I mean, from what I've heard about him, he carried pretty much two books with him, the Bible and Shakespeare, mm-hmm. from what I understand. And you look at somebody that had to deal with a massive issue and empathize with all parties and try to find the right thing to do. In modern times, anyway, probably nobody's faced a greater challenge than that mm-hmm. than I could think of. And so obviously he went back to probably a lot of what he read in both of those places.
Exactly. Yeah. And it also just talks about here how it's a vigorous exercise for the brain, because you're putting yourself in that situation and you're trying to figure out how you would respond to it. That's a pretty unique experience that you can't get from surfing the internet. Even if you're reading on the internet, you can't really get into it too deeply. You're kind of flitting from 5-minute article to 2-minute article and such, and then maybe watching a couple of YouTube videos in between.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting to look at the difference there in the way that the mind reacts. There's some pretty interesting studies on that, and the way, you know, we take in information in that way. And so, yeah, this is a really interesting subject to think about. Do they have any other points in there that are good that we could take away as far as, you know, other than just spending more time reading? Is there, like, certain books they're talking about?
Well, the writer does caution against reading too much online. He does cite a study that talks about how 39% of children and teens read every day on electronic devices. So he's cautioning against being too shallow in that way, because only 28% compared to those 39% actually read printed materials every day. And also, whenever you break it down as well, the ones who are reading online for the bulk of the time are 2 or 3 times less likely to actually enjoy reading. So you enjoy reading more when you get deep into it. And that's one thing it was talking about, how this generation has grown up basically connected to electronics and not really enjoying books like most past generations have.
Yeah, it's it's definitely a changing trend. And I found that for myself. If I do read a lot of things online, but it's more of like the news-related things and things that you can read quicker. But it's not the same as sitting down with a good book and spending some time. I don't know the longest I've ever read something on the internet, but I can't say it's been more than maybe 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. I don't, you know, not intentionally. It's just kind of I'm done after that point. It's almost like having like 500 TV channels.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to watch one because you're like, well, what's on the next channel? And right. It's kind of that way with the internet for me, where I'm looking, but I'm going to look at something else, and yeah. I just kind of keep going and going.
Yeah, that is what's so difficult about doing it online, and why this article especially encourages reading it on the pages. And it also lists a lot of great benefits, like how different circuits in your brain are strengthened by reading, because you do have to focus, you do have to analyze, you do have to think about what you read to truly comprehend it. If it is a challenging enough read, if you're reading something shallow on the internet from, BuzzFeed or TMZ, that's not really going to strengthen those circuits for you. It's not going to make you a deep thinker, and people who aren't deep thinkers generally would not make the best decisions either.
Yeah. And it's kind of easy to think you either are or you aren't a deep thinker, but a lot of it's just effort and training in terms of training yourself to think about something for a while. You know, another benefit of reading that I have found, reading books or print, is my eyes get stronger, I have found. Because sometimes I wear glasses, don't need them all the time, but sometimes if I spend a lot of time on the computer, I find that my eyes feel weaker and I need them. But if I'm reading a book, I find that they're stronger. So there may be something to that. At least for me, it seems like there is.
There's definitely a lot to be said about doing something and strengthening yourself. I mean, whether you're talking about your eyesight or your ability to focus for long periods of time, yeah, if you've never read a book before, it's going to be a little bit difficult to focus the first time you try to read a book. But if you're making that maybe a daily habit, trying to read half an hour a day, something like that, that's not too much time. But after a while, you find yourself going past that half hour because your attention span's getting longer, you're enjoying it more and more. You're putting yourself into these amazing stories, especially if you're picking out the right kinds of books.
Yeah, quality books. That's always the important thing. This write-up is ideas.time.com. Reading literature makes us smarter and nicer. You want to hear the joke that I always use at the bookstore?
Sure.
Not always, but sometimes when I'm buying some books, depending on who's checking me out at the cashier station there, I'll buy, a few books, and they're like, oh, thanks, and I said, thanks, and then I say, yeah, when I learn to read, this will be pretty exciting. Sometimes they laugh. Sometimes they ignore me. But
I just picked the book solely because of the cover.
Right.
The picture was nice.
Yeah. Especially if there's a fair number of them where I look like, oh, I'm because like, maybe the kids wanted to get some too. So we got a little stack there, and they're like, oh, this is a big reader here. So I always like to pretend like I don't know how to read.
Jolt them a little bit.
Yeah, the your eyes being strengthened by reading books, that definitely doesn't work for me.
Well, you can't hold them right up to your face. You got to give it a little.
I'm kidding. I always try to use osmosis.
Sleep on them?
Yeah. But actually, just very quickly, there's this new study by the Royal Society of Literature in Britain. They did a study of 2,000 people, seeing what kind of books they read and how they spend their time and stuff. And it was really interesting because about 53% of them say they've read a novel in the last 6 months. And then 30% newspaper and like other online things. And then when they needed to list someone who was a famous literature writer, the top two were Shakespeare and Charles Dickens, which is understandable because everyone knows who those are, even if you don't read them. And after them was J.K. Rowling,
right?
Which is the author of the Harry Potter books. And even Stephen King, Danielle Steele, and other like pop fiction writers and terrible writers of these horror stories mm-hmm. made the list. So I think it was really interesting seeing people are reading. I think it was encouraging that people are reading so much, but sometimes they're starting to read this, like the fiction you find at like a Walmart, like the young fiction and horror stories by Stephen King. And then of course, Harry Potter.
Right. Yeah. There's I remember when Harry Potter came out, there was a huge rush on those books and the young people wanted to read them. And that was kind of the point some brought up, like, well, hey, at least they're reading. And it's like, oh, sure, but what are you reading? I mean, that's important as well.
Yeah, there's clear distinctions between the different levels of fiction. I mean, obviously right at the top would have to be Shakespeare, and something like To Kill a Mockingbird, that's a really touching book, and it also does give you a historical perspective as well, so there's also value to that. But when you start getting into fantasy and sci-fi too much, then that could just be a waste of time.
Yeah, sometimes people want to be transported to another place and time, which sometimes could be interesting, but sometimes you don't come back.
Definitely a balance there to find.
You got to find a balance. But anyway, really interesting to see that article there. Reading literature makes us smarter and nicer. And you're a smart and nice guy, Grant.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for bringing that to us.
Thanks.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG. Thanks for joining us on this Thursday edition. For myself, Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, Abraham Blondeau, we're glad that you're with us today. Abraham, you've got an interesting article here, technology-related. This is from Quartz. IBM has figured out how to store data on a single atom. They're always trying to improve how much you can store in a little area. I think about it in terms of like computer storage, right? Because 15 years ago, you know, you think about what a gig, you know, how much a gig of space cost.
Right.
A gig, you know, oh, man. And now, you know, I have a thing sitting on my desk, which is, I forget how many terabytes. And it's like the size of a garbage can. It's tiny. It's like a small garbage can. And it's terabytes and terabytes of space. And it's not as expensive as it used to be. So they're continuing in this trend. And now, as this article points out, they're storing data on a single atom.
Yeah, this is one of the most exciting advancements I've read about in a while, because it is just fascinating how they figure this out. Because as you mentioned, they're always trying to make things lighter, because most of a computer or other things are your memory space. And computers and other electronics hold memory using magnetic disks, and that magnetic disk will have the information saved on it. And that's how they store information. And they use different materials to make those and that lighter ones, and that's how they try to improve it. But this takes it to a whole nother level. And to understand this, it is pretty, it's much more complicated than how they describe it here, of course. But basically, every computer program is made up of one and zeros, like the Matrix, like all those numbers
right.
scrolling past the screen, where you have a one means switching on something, and the zero means turning off, like a light switch. When the code hits one, it will flip the lever to on, whether that's an electronic code or even a mechanical one in your computer. Those ones and zeros tell your computer what to do, what to remember, like where the information is going. So everything is made up of these ones and zeros. And generally, they save these on these magnetic disks. Right now, the average hard drive uses about 100,000 atoms to store a single bit of information. So to store like one command of those ones and zeros in a normal hard drive, it takes the space of 100,000 atoms, which is still very, very small. But what they did now to make it the size of an atom is really ingenious. So basically, instead of saving the command of one or zero, like inputting that command, imprinting it on a magnetic disk, what they did now was they take a single atom of holmium. Holmium is a very rare element. They take a single atom of that, they put it between two bars of magnesium oxide, like two materials, so the atom's just sitting there by itself. And for the one and zero command, they use the two poles of magnetism, north and south, basically, positive and negative.
Mm-hmm.
So when they... So what they can do is send a little electronic impulse to this single atom. When they want to turn something on, it will rotate. The plus, like the positive side, will rotate up. And then when they turn it off, it will rotate the opposite direction. And they can tell what direction it's facing by using a single iron atom, kind of like a compass, because it's magnetized to the north pole, the north side of it. So whenever the atom, iron atom moves, they know which way it's pointing. But basically, by using the single atom rotating between the two magnetic poles, they can store a single command of on and off that usually would take up the space of 100,000 atoms. And so that's how they store this command, by using magnetism and rotating this this holmium atom. Now, to do this, though, it's not practical yet. The atom has to be held in place at a chilly minus 450 degrees Fahrenheit for this to work.
It's like a Canadian winter.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's pretty much what our fridge is like all the time. But basically, this allows that command to be stored in just in one atom. And they're hoping that this can be a breakthrough in how we store information in the future. It's really exciting. Obviously, this is just the first step. But I just find it amazing that we can control a single atom now and to store actual information on it.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Yeah, it's... Just really mind-boggling in a lot of ways. The every time technology advances, data has to get moved. You know, you think of it like, for most people, the VHS or a cassette tape to a DVD or a CD, and then your CDs and your DVDs were uploaded to a digital format online, or on your computer so you could play them off of iTunes or whatever you wanted to use. And so everything keeps getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And, obviously, just in our lifetimes, we've all had probably cassettes and then CDs and things. And to the point where now you could, depending on your phone or your device, usually a phone, you can have thousands of songs just sitting on your phone. And you use it to call people and do other things. It's amazing. Years ago, you had your CD player. Then you had next to your telephone, you had all these different devices doing things. Your CD collection was a tower against the wall, maybe, if you had a few. And now you can have literally thousands upon thousands, millions, just, depending on the storage device you have. And so those are practical things we've seen, and we all have seen that happen. And now this is going to the next level, which is obviously beyond the grasp of most of us, but fascinating.
Yeah, they say their goal, this is IBM, their goal is to store the entirety of iTunes' 35 million song music library on a drive the size of a credit card.
Wow.
So being able to hold 35 million songs, like the full length MP3 files on a single drive the size of a credit card. That's just incredible. Yeah. And this is just, it's going to be a while till we can buy something that has this kind of technology. But still, I think it is a testament to the human mind, and what it reminded me of is that we're kind of getting a little closer to mimicking creation, because a single human cell, so the smallest living entity on a human body, the cells that make us up, inside of those cells is the nucleus, and that nucleus has all our DNA code, has such complex information on the tiny infinitesimal piece of your body, that this is what they're trying to do. They're trying to replicate how our body reacts. And in that tiny nucleus of a cell, there's more information telling everything in our body what to do than we could possibly store anywhere. And that's just incredible that in creation that it already exists, what man's trying to reproduce here.
Yeah, I had a similar thought to that when you were talking about the story. They are getting closer in some ways to trying to create something in a way that God would do it. So it's very interesting. But what I also find interesting about a lot of the technology that we all use every day, I'm assuming people are like me, I don't know how to make it. You know what I mean? To where if the knowledge was lost, I would have no idea how to start it again. Even the most basic things, make a car, make a phone, anything. It would be, because we all are very advanced in terms of the society in general because of what we have. But how many people actually know how to make these things? Not that many. So we're very advanced, but yet at the same time, in some ways, maybe a little more ignorant than even people have been in the past, because just some basic things we don't need to know how to do, and let alone some of these more advanced things.
Yeah. Well, history has a lot of examples of how knowledge was lost, because, and especially today, imagine if electronics were wiped out somehow.
Yeah.
We couldn't have access to electronics. How much do we actually know? On how much of the information we know or each of us understand how to do practical things is recorded on a piece of paper we can look at or in our memories. Very little. Most of it is digital. So while these advancements are impressive, they're still, I think, more vulnerable. This is the most vulnerable information age ever, because the information can be destroyed much more easily than it used to.
Yeah, for sure. So really, really fascinating. That's from Quartz. IBM has figured out how to store data on a single atom. Yeah, all kinds of things happening there. Here's one other one we've got in the time remaining. Pretty interesting that you've got for us by Richard Langworth. Trump, Russia, and Churchill's wisdom. I guess he's talking about how Churchill dealt with Russia, and President Trump maybe could look at that history. It might be some valuable lessons.
Yeah. Richard Langworth, he's considered probably the most eminent Churchillian historian living right now. And so basically in this article, he's just showing that Donald Trump has said he wants to make a deal with Vladimir Putin. He wants to make a deal with Russia. And Mr. Langworth just goes through some of the history of Churchill had the same idea. So did Franklin Roosevelt. They want to make a deal with Joseph Stalin. But as the history shows, it was not very successful. It was met with a lot of failure. And I think this is vital history to look at because we're making the same mistakes in foreign policy that those leaders did. And so from Churchill's perspective, right before the war started, there were two threats to world security. It was Hitler and Nazism in Germany, and then communism in Russia. And he recognized the two threats, but thought that Hitler was much more dangerous. And he was, in the short run there. Germany was much more aggressive than Russia. But he had no... He wasn't fooled by anything in Russia. He spoke very critically of Stalin and of Russia's socialism and communism. And but he recognized that Britain needed Russia's help in order to fight against Hitler. And Britain in the past had always backed the second strongest power in Europe to create a balance of power there. So it made sense for Britain to help Russia fight against Germany, or else Germany could have conquered all of Europe. That would have been disastrous. However, as is documented in 1944, when the war was turning against Hitler and the Allies were on the verge of victory, there was the Yalta Conference, where Churchill, Franklin Roosevelt, and Stalin all met together. And that's really where basically the borders of the Cold War were drawn up. Churchill, he did try to tell Stalin, like, you need to, once you conquer Eastern Europe, you need to leave. You need to guarantee these nations a democracy once you leave. And a lot of his counsel against trusting Russia, Churchill knew that they could be very duplicitous. They could lie to your face and they didn't have a problem doing that. And Franklin Roosevelt, actually, President Roosevelt made the mistake. He thought he could trust Stalin. Basically, he ignored Churchill, and Franklin Roosevelt thought he could, with Stalin, divvy up the world in the new world order between America and Russia, and that Stalin would uphold his commitments to it. But obviously, as history shows, that was a terrible mistake because Stalin took advantage of everything he got from Roosevelt. And Roosevelt pretty much gave him everything. So I think there's a lot of valuable history here that even these huge giants of history, Churchill and Roosevelt, thought they could deal with Stalin, thought they could try to negotiate with him. But in the end, Stalin just took advantage of them and took whatever he wanted anyway. And that's the same mindset we're seeing today, where Trump and other politicians, even President Obama before him, they're trying to make a deal with Putin, but it's not going to happen.
Yeah, and the fact that you said mindset, I think that's the key there. There's a different mindset in the West versus what you see in Russia, and I think a lot of the people in the West, the politicians and such, I don't know if they don't understand that or they don't really think much about it, but you can't come to an agreement with somebody that just thinks differently than you and has the goal of ruling the world. You know, we think that they're going to come to some sort of a reasonable peace, but they don't think that way. Historically, that's not been the case. And there is a history there of just lying to get whatever you can get. And then, you know, you keep on with your with their goals, which is world rule. And we see it throughout history. But yet, I don't know, for some reason in the West, we just don't want to believe that. We don't want to believe that they would lie to us. But they do. That's just what they do.
Yeah. Well, it goes against the common idea that the human race is always improving. That as the generations go by, we become more cooperative and we can make this world government of cooperation with all nations. And I think why Churchill, I think, understood more than other leaders is because he understood history, and he didn't buy into that new way of thinking. He had a more archaic way of thinking, where he grounded his thoughts on maybe older ways. Some things he was wrong on, but with Russia, he was right, because he was born during Queen Victoria's reign, and he saw how Russia acted then, right after the Crimean War. And so I think Mr. Trump, he has a great opportunity to steer the direction of America in the future, but he's going to run into the same problems that even a man like Churchill, with vast experience, one of the greatest statesmen ever, even he couldn't win over Joseph Stalin. So with a man like with Putin, who perhaps is more savvy than Stalin and has been playing presidents for decades, with Donald Trump being so inexperienced as a diplomat, as an executive, in politics at least, it's very rare that he'll be able to surpass the achievements of Churchill and Roosevelt in this sphere.
Yeah, and he's said, President Trump, quite often that, you know, he wants to make deals, good deals. I mean, he wants to make good deals, but it's hard to make deals with Russia. It's never, when has that ever worked in our favor? I can't think of a time. Whether it be Russia or China or anybody else, maybe we had a temporary trade deal or something that maybe was good. I don't know, but we're talking about major deals here. You know, they don't want to stay in their own territory. They want to expand their power and their reach. And like you said, there is that sort of there is that thought in the West that, well, everyone at the end of the day wants to be peaceful and just kind of all live together. And it's not the case. They want to dominate the world.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's a lot of foolishness and naivety on our leaders' part, but also with Russia, they're very, and with a lot of nations in that part of the world, they're focused on self-interest, national interest. They'll only make a deal with you if it furthers their aims. And so the only way to do that is to dangle that in front of them and guarantee that. That's what Roosevelt and Churchill did. But doing that today could really be disastrous.
Yeah, for sure. It's a much more dangerous world even than it was back then. So really interesting write-up there from Richard Langworth, Trump, Russia, and Churchill's Wisdom. That's all the time we have for today on Trump Radio Live. Thanks for joining us. The Key of David program and the Trumpet Daily Radio Show are on the way. For myself, Dwight Fault, Grant Turgeon, Abraham Blondeau, have a great rest of your Thursday. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.